You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm senior producer Connor Boyle. On the show today, Kamil Ahmed, the journalist and author, discusses his experiences reporting on the genocidal ethnic persecution of the Rohingya people in Myanmar. What does it mean for an entire people to be living in exile? That's the question being asked by Kamil Ahmed's recent book, I Feel No Peace. He joined Carl Miller recently to talk about it. Carl is research director of the Center for the Analysis of Social Media at Demos and an author too. Here's Carl with more.
Connor, thank you everyone. Very, very warm welcome from me as well, of course. Hello to this Intelligence Squared Plus event. So I'm delighted to welcome our guest tonight, Kamil Ahmed. He is a journalist at The Guardian, where he covers international development. He's previously lived and reported from Jerusalem, Bangladesh and Turkey. And his first book, which we'll be discussing today, of course, is this. It's I Feel No Peace. Let's just begin with the whole genesis, Kamil, of this book and your journalism. So when did you decide that the Rohingya was going to be kind of one of the things that you really looked at and spent so much of your time trying to cover and grow to know?
I think it's quite kind of intertwined, the start of my career and me wanting to kind of cover the Rohingya. I was at university and I think I was watching TV and it was Al Jazeera, I think, who used to be one of the few who covered a bit about the Rohingya. And it was just very striking to me when I saw these people who I'd never heard of, an ethnic group I'd never heard of, but who are arriving on the borders of Bangladesh and spoke a language very similar to, especially like my region's dialect of Bengali, which is more Eastern. Yet I also couldn't understand it. And I was kind of intrigued by these people who seemed similar, but also I'd just never heard of it, but also at the same time, very strange to me. Very kind of new to me. And I think also it was a time when I studied history, so I was becoming very interested in kind of what happened with the borders of kind of colonial times and the post-colonial times and the peoples who lay on either side of these borders. And the Rohingya kind of really fit into that. I think they were a community who were kind of excluded. Their place in history is much more complex than a group who migrated or who were here or there. And it doesn't fit into our modern concept of borders because kingdoms and sultanates and empires all moves those borders around them, and it just became something that very interested me, and especially because it wasn't something that was being covered much. And I realized that once a couple of years later when I got into journalism, it still wasn't being covered much. There was at that time, I think still already talk of genocide, especially after 2012, kind of intercommunal riots in Sitwe, the capital of Rakhine State, where they're from. And it was just very kind of striking that a people could face so much violence and systematic kind of exclusion from their country. And it really didn't make any impact on the news agenda. And I think what I wanted to do in journalism, very idealistically, was like to take up stories that weren't the ones on the front of the agenda. I think someone once called me like patron saint of lost causes. Yeah, so like that's kind of how it all started. And with it pretty early on, I started off by editing stories for other people. I quite quickly became a South Asia editor at my first job. And so I was kind of commissioning people to write. And then by 2015 was when I was actually reporting myself.
And kind of in an age of kind of 800 word hot takes and churn and newswire, like it so struck me how what you've presented in this book are these kind of extremely long form, kind of deeply immersive stories of people that you've clearly got to know very well over a long period of time. Did you set out at the very beginning to do that kind of journalism, Camille, to go there, to get to know them, to almost live with them, it seems, at times, and travel with them to kind of bring that story back in that way?
Yeah, I think so. I think what happened is in 2015, there was the, like, what they call the boat crisis, the discovery of mass graves in Thailand, which kind of forced a light onto the boat trafficking that have happened for years between Bangladesh and Myanmar, kind of the Bay of Bengal region, so jointly Bangladesh and Myanmar to Malaysia. But it happened through Thailand. It was a very complex system. And in these trafficking camps, people had been dying and they'd been putting them into mass graves. And that discovery forced Thailand to act, even though for years there had been reports of people dying at sea, boats capsizing or boats being pushed back. And it kind of just, that was it. It was reported and nothing else happened. There was not much digging deeper. So the 2015 boat crisis kind of forced the light on that. But while most people, Bangladesh doesn't have many kind of English language reporters who aren't Bangladeshi, who aren't working for Bangladeshi media, and so who don't report to an international audience, apart from a few for the wires who do. They do wires stories. They have to move with their agenda and have little time for kind of in-depth reporting. So 2015 brought me there. I was one of the few who was able to go to the Bangladeshi side and see the camps at a time when a lot of people don't realize camps existed, but actually had possibly around 150,000 people. And I learned a lot from a guy called Nobby, who's like kind of crops up throughout the book, who really was like the first person to really introduce me into what life was like for someone who was a few years old when he left Myanmar in the early 1990s, settled in Bangladesh, and ever since then has lived in Bangladesh and has not been able to return to Myanmar, has not been able to be resettled to any other country, and has just lived in a refugee camp for 30 years. And I really did. It took me until 2017 to actually go back again, even though but the idea of the book started then at a time when people's eyes glazed over when I mentioned the Rohingya. I wanted to do the book and I started doing the archival research then. And I was in constant, regular contact with Nobby over kind of messaging apps until I had the chance to go back. What happened as well is from Bangladesh, I moved to Jerusalem, so I couldn't so easily go after 2015. But yeah, when the big military operation happened in 2017, which sent about 700,000 to Bangladesh, it suddenly became something people recognized as an issue, but they thought of it as a new issue. And I think that's why I wanted to challenge that idea that it's a new issue, that the camps were new, that this, what is now the world's biggest refugee camp, didn't exist before 2017. And I felt like to do that, I needed to spend time with people. I needed to make regular trips and kind of follow stories. And I think what happened is it always felt like unless lessons were learned, what had happened to people like Nobby, the older generation of refugees who had been there in Bangladesh almost 30 years at that point, now more than 30 years, the kind of deprival of education, the trafficking that of them, the violence against them, the use of them in kind of by kind of drug gangs and all sorts of criminals who needed cheap labor, expendable labor, would happen again. And I think that it's starting, we're seeing signs of it now.
So let's go all the way back, Camille, for a second. Take us into this kind of land which kind of transcends or avoids this kind of borders of nation states and empires. What is Rakhine like, or Arakan, or that whole area? What's it like to live there, and the people that have lived there that have crossed all these borders? Where can we trace their origins back to?
I think part of what I try to do is challenge the idea of tracing origins, because I think it's the kind of question about the Rohingya is, where are they from? And there are lots of theories about, were they labourers brought by the British on trains to harvest rice in Rakhine State? Or did they come, were they just Bangladeshis who came like during the 1971 independence war, who fled to Myanmar and just stayed and then started claiming another name? There's so many theories about how they're kind of infiltrators from elsewhere. Which is why I think the borders are important, because if you look at the River Naaf, which is kind of a massive part of the border between Bangladesh and Myanmar is this river, especially in the Cox's Bazar region. It's not very big. Like you'll go there and see it's really not very wide. So I think the idea that people didn't cross it during history, that they were static, that there was one type of people called who were Bengalis on one side, on the other side, they were a completely different type of people, is unrealistic. And so what you have in history is the Bengal kind of kingdom, the kingdom of Bengal and the kingdom of Arakan, as it was then known, it's being now called Rakhine. And they were at times friends and they were at times at war, and they would take land from each other and the border would shift. At one point, the borders of Arakan were all the way up to Chittagong, which is like one of Bangladesh's second city, the major port. So these things have shifted massively over time and through history. And with that came a lot of population movement. There were, when Bengal held influence over the Rakhine State after it helped one of the Rakhine kings reconquer a kingdom that he'd been kicked out of before, it had its advisors in the court, and its advisors kind of contributed to poetry and all sorts of, and literature, and even like there were coins that had kind of Islamic or Arabic script on them. The linkage between the two places is massive, and actually the linkage was in many ways stronger than between Rakhine State and the Burmese kingdom at that time, which only took over Rakhine State very shortly before the British did. And then remained under British control until the independence of Burma from Britain. So it's just been such a fluid border and so much movement of people. Even there used to be Rakhine pirates who, together with the Portuguese, used to kidnap Bengalis from the kind of Bay of Bengal and sell them as slaves in the Rakhine capital at the time. There's just been so much kind of movement of people, which I think... the real problem is now suddenly independence happened and we pretend that people were where they always have been, and that anyone who doesn't seem to fit in came from somewhere else and has infiltrated. I mean, you see in Bangladesh, there are quite a lot of ethnic Rakhine people who are full citizens of Bangladesh.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
So, to tell us about the kind of post-independence years. So how did Myanmar always, the kind of regime, always believe that the Rohingya were, as you said, kind of interlopers or kind of infiltrators from Bangladesh? Is that idea as old as the state itself?
There's a little bit of tension at the beginning, because what you have is that's a front line between British forces and Japanese forces. And so there's this idea that Rohingya had sided with the British and the Rakhine had sided with the Japanese, and that the British had kind of promised the Rohingya their own state. And so there is a little bit of tension, but it's not really that significant. There's a small group who are fighting for some kind of independence or autonomy. And so that does lead to military operations in the early years. And that does also lead to some exoduses of Rohingya to Bangladesh, or it was East Pakistan at the time. But overall, they are far more a part of the state in those early years. Well, to a certain extent. I mean, those living in the kind of Sitwe, the capital, are, and those who are able to, they are able to study in all parts of Myanmar and teach. There's a man I met who's like in the camps a few years ago, who's like more than, people say he's around 100 years old, who was teaching at like a religious institute in the capital, even up to 1978. So in the early years, they're far more incorporated into the state. And Aung San Suu Kyi's father, who's the leader at the time, wants them to, is far more friendly. And the early prime ministers are far more kind of open to including them. And they have their hour or two on Burmese of Rohingya language programming on state radio. This changes from the 60s. With kind of the military, increasingly military rule. And then in 1978, there's the first really big military operation. So in the 60s, they start to lose some of their rights and privileges, like their language is now excluded from state programming. But through the 70s, they're still able to go to university, travel around. It's around that time that they lose that. And in 78, there's the first big military operation, and they call it kind of a population exercise. And what happens is they're terrified, because there are so many rumors about people being killed, and there is violence as well, but it's also just such an aggressive kind of move of the military to just kind of sweep into their areas and demand they prove that they belong. And people, and I'm sure in many parts of Myanmar, they wouldn't be able to show you the paperwork. People are just very scared and believe they're being kicked out of the country. And that's really the start. At that point, they still have citizenship, many of them. Those with papers, but yeah, they have the right to citizenship. But they lose that. In 1982, they're completely excluded from citizenship. And that's, so it's that period in the late 70s and 80s where you really see a change.
Okay, so let's jump forwards a bit. So let's go to the 1990s now and the camps that have grown up on the other side of the river, camps I know you visited at parts. Take us into those camps. Like, what are they like? I mean, it's later, I think, but there's a quote which stayed with me from your book where one tells you, one of your interviewees tells you, this is not to life, this is just survival.
Yeah, I think that's really what the camps, the kind of camp existence is. They really developed very little since the 1990s. Someone who's been there since 1991, they might have possibly they've been moved a couple of times, but they basically live where they have since the 90s. The basic frame of their shelter maybe has been slightly upgraded from bamboo and tarpaulin to a little bit of wire, and maybe they were able to put a bit of concrete on the floor to kind of protect it from becoming waterlogged, and put some metal sheeting on the roof. That's really the best that they've been able to do. They are not allowed education, not to any kind of real extent. There's very, very basic primary level education. At secondary levels, there's very limited services. Bangladesh, which kind of has long had this idea of wanting to prevent so-called pull factors, to avoid having pull factors that would bring more Rohingya, has not allowed that. Has also not allowed Bengali curriculum because it doesn't want the Rohingya to integrate and kind of to assimilate and claim they're Bangladeshis. And so they've been really deprived of the most basic rights. There's no education, very limited healthcare. The people I talk to, like Nobby, are very regularly quite badly ill, and cannot easily go to a hospital. They can't travel beyond their camps. They can't work. They somehow often find a little bit of work, or maybe NGOs are able to give them, those who can work with NGOs sometimes get a little stipend, but they're not able to do meaningful work without the risk of being arrested for being beyond the camp. And so it makes it a temporary existence. It makes it constantly, they're just trying to survive, to find a bit of money to buy more than what they're given for rations. And you see, like, and there's some, in the last couple of years, you've seen so many examples of events that have highlighted why they believe this is so precarious. Nobby, after 30 years, his home was burnt down in 30 minutes in a fire a couple of years ago. It was just like, that moment just like really struck me that this is what they've been left to, like to spend your whole, he grew up in the camps, his children are now growing up in the camps, and their home can kind of suddenly go. Yeah, it's really kind of full of these situations. They talk often about a loss, feeling like there's a lost fearing a lost generation, people who are just completely unable to access education, who will not be able to, and who will be a step behind in the future, who will not be able to advocate for themselves, who will be completely reliant on aid. Being reliant on aid is a real, like, big concern. They're forced to be because they can't work, because they can't go back, but they don't want to be. And like the past week highlighted that when WFP cut their food rations by 17% because of a lack of donor funding. And it said it could become a bigger cut in the next couple of months if more money isn't given. Because with all the, with coronavirus and then Ukraine, funding has massively dropped and been sent to places where the donor countries feel there's more need, or which their interests are more aligned.
Okay, well, we've spoken about Bangladesh, and I'm keen to talk in a moment about the aid community and UNHCR and the World Food Programme and the international NGOs. But before that, let's talk about Myanmar itself. So we've heard from, you know, maybe a ambivalent beginning, this kind of increasing pressure through the 70s and to the 90s. And I think we probably need to tackle now, Camille, the kind of moments of grotesque and crescendic violence that happened in 2012 going through to 2017. Do you want to take us into Tula Toli, the village, and just give people a sense of what actually happened there?
Yeah, Tula Toli is just really like kind of the most striking example. It fits a pattern of violence. What happened in some ways is similar. The pattern of what happened in some ways is similar to what happened in many other villages, but it was also very extreme. There had always been fear of this extreme since 2012, when there were intercommunal riots and many massacres of Rohingya. And soon afterwards, there was a massacre in a place called Kiladong, in a village called Kiladong, which really kind of had a significant impact on kind of Rohingya as collective. They feared the massacre in Kiladong, where people were buried in mass graves, would happen again. And in 2017, it did. It happened in many villages, and in Tula Toli, it happened to so many people. It wasn't the first of the villages to be targeted by the military operation in 2017, which started on 25th of August. And so what had happened is they'd been speaking to the local administrator who was from the Rakan ethnicity. And they'd been thinking of leaving, because by that time, tens of thousands of people, maybe already hundreds of thousands, were already coming to Bangladesh. But he had convinced them that he would not allow violence to happen to them. He would protect them. In reality, he was collaborating with the military and organized an attack that left the Rohingya residents of Tula Toli completely trapped, and also some people who had fled other villages and sought safety there. And so what happened is the military kind of encircled the village, fired at it. There's talk, which there often is talk, about kind of grenade launchers or rocket launchers being used that in their houses, which are quite basic, kind of just tear through and create fires and a massive amount of fear. So that was what many people heard first. And then the military came through, and it was extremely brutal. Not just shooting, but they used machetes. Everyone was attacked. They killed the men, they killed the children, and a lot of women were raped. And many, many women were. And so one of them was someone called Momtaz Begum, who I interviewed, and who has actually been interviewed by many people, because her story is one of the worst. She managed to survive. She had been locked in a burning house, but managed to survive with one of her daughters. She lost all her other children and her husband. And she managed to crawl out, and someone found her and carried her into Bangladesh, where she was treated and eventually managed to build some kind of life, or just had to get through it. And at first she thought she was by herself. She thought she'd lost all her sisters, as well as her own children and her husband. I actually came to her at a time when she had just found her younger sister. She had just been reunited with her younger sister, who was like kind of sitting in the back as we were talking. And we realized that. At first I didn't realize, because she was kind of very quiet, but then she started to get involved in the conversation. And it just showed how Tula Toli was just such a kind of, it left such a mark. Even within the camps, they ended up living together often. This kind of, I heard this, I heard someone from another village, another area of Rakhine State once saying, like, how describing it as an area that was like no one really slept well. You heard screams at night. It was like extreme trauma because so many of them lost their family members. They all saw extreme violence. They had to escape by kind of swimming across a river. And also many people, it was violence that was seen by other villages. Other villages saw it and could see what was happening and fled. There's another woman called Anwara Bergum who lives in a village downstream of Tula Toli, and she'd been to Bangladesh twice before in 1978 and 1992. Her son had died in 1992 because of the cold in the camps. And he developed a respiratory illness that wasn't treated. And when she was forced back in 92, or around 92, when she was forced back, she had actually promised to never go back to Bangladesh. But the violence in Tula Toli was so apparent that she just couldn't see herself staying. And it turned out Tula Toli was really kind of the big one that everyone knows, but there were many massacres. There was Indin, which was the execution of men and burial in mass grave, which Reuters discovered and ended up in, their discovery of that ended up in two of their Burmese journalists being arrested. And there were others. I found so many cases of where, yeah, full-on attacks or kind of things where men were called into meetings by the military or by authorities and they were executed. And then their families, once they realized that happened, left. Actually, most of these stories didn't make it into the book because it would be too much. But the first, for the my first kind of trip after 2017, everyone had a story. It was so, so widespread.
How do you as a journalist cope with all of this? This must just be unbelievably difficult to cover journalistically, I suppose, getting to know all of these people and kind of the emotional and kind of social kind of trauma which they have, and I'm sure kind of you must have felt as well.
Yeah, it's difficult, but I think it's more difficult if you feel like there's no purpose to it. I think maybe this actually slightly links to one of your earlier questions about the time I spent with them. I think what I really wanted to do is make sure, and I try to do it as much as I can in general reporting, but it's difficult. This was the one time I could really commit to this, is follow the story and follow the people and stick to the people. Because Mumtaz is a really good example of her and her sister, who had a very similar experience, were photographed and interviewed a lot, once, by people who never came back and never spoke to them again. And they don't know what happened with any of that. I've seen Mumtaz's sister Dilda. I've seen her photo on charity ads on billboards in this country, in London. A photo taken in 2017 being used in 2021 to fundraise. And I don't think anyone's spoken to her since. I think what's difficult is when you feel like you're not doing, when you're just talking to them and not doing anything with it and just extracting. As much as we might think sometimes that we're doing things we're working towards a good purpose, it also sometimes feels to me that if you talk to someone, get their trauma, get their story, and then put in a quote, package it into a quote, and then move on, it's also exploitative. So I've tried to spend more time. I've tried to go back to them, see what's happened with their lives, where have their lives gone since then, and hopefully package it into something that is more, that is deeper, and that is less piecemeal and puts together, my aim was to put together a book that gives a better understanding of kind of the systematic issues here, that through their stories, not to just explain it as someone who visited a few times, but like to actually like show through their stories how things have developed, how they have gone through so many stages of this kind of refugee process of being a refugee. And like, I think the camps themselves are almost like a character. The camps have developed. They've gone from being a shelter, a temporary shelter, to something that people have to live in and that make their lives in. And at this point, it looks like indefinitely. And they've gone, in 2017, not too many people were thinking of taking journeys to places like Malaysia and jumping on boats. They were just happy to be safe. Now people are very frustrated with the life in the camps. They had that period to kind of reset, to no longer like have to worry about the immediate fear of the Myanmar military, but their lives don't stop there. They can't sit in camps forever. Ones where they can't get education, they're badly fed and they can't travel, they can't work. They're just basically trapped. And so, yeah, I think following that and being someone who comes back and gives them time and like listens, I think that's something that I've hoped has a purpose. And I think that's what helps me as well, that I don't feel like I've just come and extracted what I've needed and left.
I just wanted to, you touched on it at the beginning of that answer, and that's the international aid community. Now, there seems to be kind of snippets in the book where you seem to portray, I don't know, a mixture of exasperation, criticism, whether they're back-channeling with the Bangladeshi government rather than challenging them, or whether they're introducing kind of market distortions into the local kind of food market and pushing the price of everything up. There seems to be kind of at least moments when it feels like you think that they're doing more harm than good. What stepping back now, I guess, like what's your thoughts on I guess both the United Nations and the kind of international NGO sector, and how they helped or didn't help over this period of time?
I think, of course, the UN and the NGO sector played a massive role in saving lives, in feeding people, in giving them shelter. Yeah, and just making people, kind of giving them that safety that they needed at that time. But that's not their only role. And I think that sometimes what's been seems to get forgotten in a way or brushed over. And it's something that I feel is relevant in a lot of places. I work for the Global Development Desk at The Guardian. I often have stories that relate to the humanitarian sector. They also have a responsibility to ensure safety, protection, and to ensure that people aren't returned to unsafe conditions. And in that, they have failed since 1978. They failed the Rohingya. The Rohingya have been returned twice. And without any kind of, without much say in it, they've had their decisions made for them. And I think it's really striking when you go to Cox's Bazar now, because Cox's Bazar is a kind of tourist resort for Bangladesh as well. And they're in really, really expensive hotels, and their staff change over constantly. There are a few people who really, really committed to it and were brilliant and made massive differences and were able to develop who were able to help get things beyond the basics, who committed to things like making sure they could grow food in their own shelters, or that they had access to fuel supplies. I think one of the most striking things I didn't realize is, before this, no refugee response had ever provided fuel. to refugees, which is why they were walking miles for hours to cut down trees for wood. And obviously with a million people cutting down trees, that forest disappeared very quickly, and so that they had to walk even further. It's obviously a very important system, and there is a lot of good work done, but they have a lot of responsibilities, and it sometimes feels like once political considerations come into play, once a government not wanting to bear the burden of a large refugee population, which it shouldn't have to by itself, but starts putting pressure on and saying that it's going to do this or that, that it wants to send people back, or that it wants to send them to an island, or that these people shouldn't be working, or they shouldn't have education, or they shouldn't be running their own education system. That very, very rarely does the UN or the humanitarian sector push back strongly enough or at all. They often capitulate. And it seems that to do one task, the basic task of providing food and shelter, which is what I think everyone sees, maybe the general public sees as their purpose, to do that, they'll often accept quite serious violations of the rest of their mandate. And I think that's what's happened. And that's what I struggle with when I see a rotation of people, the spokespeople or the staff you talk to are constantly changing. Every time you visit, there's a new person in a new role who doesn't know the history. Some of people genuinely didn't know there were many refugees before 2017. They thought the camps just existed. They were just created. But I think there's that quote from the UN's evaluation of the 1990s repatriations, which were involved a lot of coercion, where a UN official said, they'll listen to what we say, they're primitive people, which you'd hope isn't the case anymore, that there are people saying that. But I have spoken to people who were involved in 2017 operation who say they might not have used those words, but the approach wasn't necessarily much different. There is still a kind of patronizing approach from the humanitarian system, which does what it does the job it needs, but also maybe you could argue as well is kind of, it does what it needs to sustain itself as well. It does just enough to get funding and to keep going, but does it actually fulfill its role? And is it respectful and does it give dignity to the people it's serving? And I feel like there's a real question about that when the Rohingya, when it's participated in forced repatriations. And I think the issue about the forced repatriations and the lack of Rohingya role is not just about dignity. I think it also in practical terms, the Rohingya were forced back in 1978. They came back in the 1990s in larger numbers, and they were forced back again. In 2017, they came back in about three times more people came in 2017. So if you don't solve the problem, it's one, they will remain vulnerable.
The question is essentially, what would a sustainable, peaceable solution look like in your eyes, I guess? Alongside that, should there be, I guess, accountability, international criminal court trials to prosecute the Myanmar military and the other kind of participants in the crimes that you've told us about today?
Yeah, I think international justice plays an important role. There is a trial at the International Courts of Justice in The Hague on genocide. There's an investigation by the ICC into forced deportation. Both are taking very long. The case at the ICC hasn't even started. It's just an investigation still. So hopefully they'll pave some way and create some urgency. The US has recognized, as now calls it, genocide. They've moved away from the term. They used to often say ethnic cleansing. They now call it genocide. So we would hope that changes things. A solution for Rohingya, what Rohingya will always say is they need citizenship back. They need citizenship restored. What was taken away in 1982 must be restored. because they cannot keep living under this kind of apartheid system where they can't travel beyond their villages, they can't get education. They either live under almost complete control in like open prisons in their villages, where people still die in healthcare or in pregnancy or through all sorts of kind of just through deprivation, or, and that's in the best case scenario, or they're subjected to extreme violence, and they need that cycle to be broken and some kind of guarantee. They see citizenship as like really the important way to do that, and they won't accept, because in the past it's been kind of, they've been sent back without that being restored, and it's pretty much unanimous among the Rohingya that that has to be, that is in a very important condition. They need to be equal members of society.
Thank you very much, everyone. Camille, thank you for I thought a extremely harrowing at times, but very meaningful and important and kind of poignant series of reporting and journalism and stories that you've brought to us today. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you for all your brilliant questions. Sorry I couldn't quite get through them all by the end. The book again is I Feel No Peace, Rohingya Fleeing Over Seas and Rivers. I'm Carmilla, and you've been listening to Intelligence Squared.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Connor Boyle and edited by Tom Hall. We'd love to hear your feedback and what you think we should be talking about next. Send us an email or a voice note with your thoughts to podcasts@intelligencesquared.com. And if you'd like to hear more, attend some of our live events, or peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds, then head over to intelligencesquared.com.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.